Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars. Join NITP this morning for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
Good morning and welcome to For Your Benefit. We're going to talk this morning about, is risk risky or is it not? And to lead us in that discussion is Joe Sullender, Certified Financial Planner, Wells Fargo Advisors, Senior Vice President of Investments. Did I say that right?
That's perfect. You got it.
Okay, good. It's been a while, Joe.
Yeah.
Okay, when I hear the term, or when clients hear the term, risky, and they think of something with a lot of risk to it. Mm-hmm. But in fact, there's a risk, I suppose, in a CD, if you buy it for a long period of time, that you would lose out if interest rates go up, mm-hmm. if interest rates go down. But help me with where the cliff is between risk and what makes a lot of sense and risky that makes no sense.
Yeah, risk is a complicated word that when you throw it out there, it means a bunch of different things to a lot of different people. I think some people tend to think of risk in investing as the risk of losing all their money, or the risk of, you know, losing half or more of their money, when really what risk, I think a better way to define it in investing is volatility or unpredictability. You know, a lot of folks know that risk dissipates over time, that if you give an investment a longer period of time, like the stock market, for instance, that the longer time frame you have, the more the risk and unpredictability goes away because the market cycles come and go. Well, that's sort of what we try to measure with risk, is sort of what is that unpredictability that you might have? I mean, what are the odds if an investment says it should get you 6-7% a year, what are the odds that that's exactly what you will see over a certain period of time?
Right. And with dividends, with some stocks, they pay dividends, some stocks don't. Is one that pays the dividend better than one that doesn't?
Well, sometimes the dividend can help stabilize the risk because you're getting paid while you're holding on to that particular stock. But, you know, there's a lot of ways to measure risk. And the it's funny, over the years of doing this, about almost 20 years now, you know, I kind of have moved away from the statistical analysis of risk, even though that's what I do behind the scenes at my desk, is look at standard deviations and betas and alphas and Sharpe ratios, mm-hmm. and that sort of thing. What I think really risk is to the average investor is when things get bad, you know, we go through a period like 2008 and early 2009. How much money am I really going to lose? I mean, it's an emotional experience when you ask somebody about risk, of the risk of not, am I going to make more money than I expected? No one cares about that. That's good. The risk of when things get bad, how far down are my investments going to drop? And can I afford to ride out that sort of volatility at the stage of their life that they're in?
Okay. You know, it's a Fed audience, and there's a group of funds, which I'm sure you're aware of, called the L funds, the mm-hmm. life funds. And in that kind of like shared risk, the older mm-hmm. you get, the more it'll constrict itself.
There's two ways that those manage risk. One is in just simply the diversity inside the funds. Each L fund has a little bit of the other five TSP options you can pick individually. So by spreading your money out among all these different categories that don't directly correlate, you know, stocks go up, bonds maybe don't do as well, and vice versa. So you've got a nice blend inside of those funds to reduce the volatility. The second way they reduce risk is over time. Is that's why you might find that L2050, the more aggressive fund, is more in stocks, whereas the ones that like L Income and L2020 are more in the G fund and the F fund to help reduce the volatility. So the sort of two ways I think you can really reduce, I won't say reduce the risk, increase the predictability of your investments, is with time, which the L funds do give you, and with diversification across more than just one category, which you get there as well.
Okay, questions in class. We do seminars for NITP. We do retirement seminars, mid-career, beginning career, and we answer a fair amount of emails even for people that retire. So I won't ask you what's the most common question you got, because we'd be here all day. But with regards to risk, when somebody says, well, you know, I have my money in the G fund and the C fund is risky, how do you talk them off the ledge?
Talk them off the ledge how? As far as
they don't want to go to the C fund because it's risky and the G fund is not, and they're making, you know, they're doing better than what they could do outside, but not great. Mm-hmm. How do you get them to move over?
Well, I almost reframe it a little in that I don't know that I necessarily try to get them to move over, in the respect that everyone has a certain tolerance for risk. And if you, the key to really investing successfully is finding a mix that gives you both the returns you need to meet your goals with a risk level that you can be comfortable with, even, and I won't say even, when times get bad. That's the problem. I mean, you don't see people panicking when investments do better than expected. It's when we go through these negative times where the media and everybody else is telling us it's the end of the world. People see their accounts dropping and dropping and dropping. The real key to your success is being able to be in a portfolio that you can stick with during that time frame. So if somebody told me they were 100% G, then maybe that's their risk tolerance. Maybe they're the kind of person that if their account dropped a dollar, that they would be tossing and turning and sleeping at night. So I've learned over my career not to try to push people to be more aggressive than they necessarily feel comfortable being, even if we know long run they'll make more money, because the key is being able to stay in the investments.
Okay. And some people may not need any risk. And
that's
like you say,
true.
If it caused them to lose sleep, they'd say, okay, I'll lose some sleep or I won't, because it doesn't make any difference.
Well, one thing we do with financial planning is I'll run forecasts for people with their government retirement and all their other money and say, how much return do you really need on this money to meet your goals? For some people, it's none. I mean, they can live off of their retirement check. So as far as they're concerned, their TSP and their other money is just gravy. Others may need 3%, 4%, 5%. Now, I have had scenarios where somebody needs 8%, 9% on their TSP and they're 100% G. So what do you tell them? You tell them, well, you need to either be more aggressive or you're not going to be able to retire. But there are other options. They could save more money. They could retire later. They could work in retirement. And I mean, I think for some people, working 3 more years is better than the nerves that they're going to create by throwing their money in something more aggressive than they feel comfortable doing.
Okay, let me take a little tangent here. Mm-hmm. For years, and I'm an accountant, and I understand your world, but I can't live in it.
and same with me with your world, Bob.
Well, that's what makes everything work.
Exactly.
Okay, so I read these things about the 4% rule way back when.
Sure.
And now I'm reading articles that say, well, the 4% rule maybe should be the 3% rule. But I think it gets back to what you just said. It depends on what they have outside of their investments, and somebody might need the 9% rule. But what is the 4% or the 3%? What is it?
Sure. What that is, I mean, obviously when I do financial planning at my desk doing this for a living, we do it more in a more sophisticated calculation. But people often either don't have the resources or don't want to take the time. They just want to know, all right, I've got $400,000 in my TSP. How much can I use? I mean, how much can I withdraw without worry about spending all of my money? That's where the 4% rule or 3% rule came into play, is that if you have, you know, $100,000, that the most you should take out every year without worry of exhausting the funds would be about 3% to 4%. So it gives you a good sort of ballpark, which I do think is a very fairly accurate one, to just sort of a back of a napkin calculation to see where you stand.
Okay, good. We have a caller. Good morning. Hello.
Morning.
Good morning, Joe.
Hi there.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm a federal employee, and I am retiring the first of the year, January 2014.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a lot of different programs that I've invested money in, including the TSP. I also have something called voluntary contributions.
Sure.
Which has really been very, excuse me, very good. It's part of my financial plan. I do have mutual funds, and I do have S&P mutual funds that track the S&P 500. My question is, I'm pretty much set on most of my investments, and when I retire, some of them do have to be canceled out, and I do have to put them in like a 401k.
Mm-hmm.
The one that concerns me the most is my voluntary contributions. I'm pretty much maxed out as far as what my contributions can be to that fund. And I know when I retire that I have to take those funds out, and I have to put them into some type of a 401k account. My biggest problem is, after reading your article and concerns as far as our risk tolerance, I'm just wondering, I'm not really sure in what direction to go. Honestly, I don't have a financial consultant. I've been doing this all on my own.
Mm-hmm.
But I do know that I have to take that voluntary contributions, the full amount, and put it into some type of a 401k. And I'm just wondering what type might be available for, you know, the lowest risk tolerance possible.
Okay.
Let me give you a procedural and a tax that does have a financial positive to it, and then Joe will, of course, talk about the financial side. The voluntary contribution, if you've been doing it for years, it enjoyed a pretty nice interest rate, and now it's still better than most you can get on the outside with a government guarantee. But like you say, at the end of the road, so to speak, with regards to federal employment, you can actually leave it in there, and you would get a greater annuity. So it would supplement your annuity. However, the older you are, it's, I would say, more attractive than the younger you are at retirement. And, you know, how do you define old versus young? I would say if you're retiring at 60, early 60s, late 50s, maybe up to 65, I don't know that I would leave the money in there to get the greater annuity, or you could do a piece of it. But your comment just I'm not being a pain in the neck, but I am an accountant, so I have to be a pain in the neck. So it can't go into a 401k. The earnings could. For example, the earnings, when you put the money in the voluntary contribution, you get no tax deduction. But the earnings would be tax deferred. And when they come out, if you take it, you'd pay taxes on it, but you can actually move that into the thrift. Hard to believe, but you can move that into the thrift. If you feel that you would maybe like to move it some other place, you're free to move it to any type IRA you want. There wouldn't be any tax. But the principal can be moved into a Roth IRA, which is kind of hard to believe, isn't it? Regardless of your income. And we're going to do a whole show, oddly enough, on it next Monday. We do it once a year, Tammy and I. And she talks about the rules of the voluntary contribution, and I talk about the tax side of it, but it'll be in the entire show. So I hope that helped, but I think you didn't want to hear that. You wanted to hear Joe make a proclamation.
Well, I mean, the problem that you've got, if you want to be real conservative, is the G fund and the interest in the voluntary contributions accounts are much higher than anything you're going to find outside. I mean, the G fund and the TSP pays basically the average. I think it's the 30-year treasury and the 4-year treasury. So you're getting long-term interest rates, even though it's fully liquid short-term money. So you're going to go from getting a better interest rate to a worse interest rate if you move it out. However, the idea that Bob brought up of moving the principal at least to the Roth IRA, I think even with maybe a little bit of a hit in the interest rate makes sense, because that money would then grow tax-free from here on out, and presumably interest rates rise at some point and you get, you know, a little better yield. But you may want to move the, as Bob pointed out, the earnings even to the TSP if you were just looking for where can I get the most interest for my buck without taking any risk at all. You know, so it's, I wish I had a better answer for you. In this interest rate environment, you know, it's hard to find much better than the 1.5 or 2% that you might get on the G or the voluntary contributions.
Sure. No, I appreciate what both of you have said on that. I'm not disappointed. my biggest problem has been I'm just trying to avoid the taking the money out, not putting it into any type of a Roth IRA or anything like that, but paying that tax on the deferred interest. I would prefer just to leave it into the account that it now has and just let it sit there at 1.5%. I don't plan on using any of that money at this point. I was surprised, and I just want to reconfirm this too, is that from what I understand, the earnings I could put right into my TSP plan. I mean, we're talking the voluntary contributions. I thought I had to take that out when I retired, period.
Well, you do have to close down the voluntary contribution account at retirement. It's just a matter of where that money goes. And you could simply move the earnings into the TSP from the voluntary contributions and the principal into a Roth IRA. That would be the no tax way to accomplish it.
Next week when we do this, we're going to have a 16-page PDF on the website that anybody listening to the show should print out first. And we'll walk you through the actual form. And on that form, and we'll forget the form number for a second, on the back of the form it says, what do you want to do with the interest?
Yeah.
And then the other half says, what do you want to do with the principal? So in fact, you could move the interest.
Yep.
It could go into the TSP, and if you want the principal to play with it, then you can have that.
Yep. That'll make sense to you, I think.
Well, you know what I will do? I will be waiting very much with bated breath to see that article and take advantage of it.
Okay, listen to the show now next week. The first 15 minutes or so will be nothing but the voluntary contribution. Because our audience has got a fair number of FERS people, they don't want to hear about that. So the remainder of the show, we'll talk about being able to get traditional IRAs into a Roth IRA without paying any tax and without flaunting any of the IRS scrutiny. Okay?
Great. Let me ask you, what time does your program start so I won't be interrupting you or whatever?
It starts every week about 10:06 a.m. on a Monday morning, and we're on to about 10:58. Now, it's rebroadcast a fair number of times throughout the month. However, this is the only time you can call. You can email us. We'll give the email address in a little bit, but you can email us at any time. Okay.
Great. Well, as I said, I will keep an eye on all of this, and I will be talking with you next Monday.
We'll be here.
Take care.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Have a great day.
You too. All righty, Joe. That was a good question.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it expressed probably a lot of the profile of the Fed with a voluntary contribution, or for that matter, with the thrift.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this gentleman called. I don't know that I gave the phone number, but let's do it. 202-465-3080. 202-465-3080. And you'll get Andrew, the ever-efficient engineer, who will guide you into the studio. All righty? So, mm-hmm. Joe, where were we? We were talking a little bit about risk. We were talking about the Yell Fund. We got several emails. And you and I were talking about them before we went on air, and I think you said you'd like the
some great questions.
Okay, so the number one, and this is a friend of the show, and the person sends us in emails throughout the week. So do other people, but he starts off, the first one says, do you believe the best allocation for a 50-year-old is 50% in stocks and 50% in bonds?
And I was going to say, this email, Bob didn't read the whole thing, but there's about five questions in here, and I appreciate it. Let's take one at a time.
I didn't want to do all five.
Do you believe the best allocation for a 50-year-old is 50-50 stocks and bonds? This is, I love when I get this question because it brings me back to the principles of financial planning. I have no idea, to be honest, what the best allocation for a 50-year-old is, because I don't know the parameters and circumstances of this particular 50-year-old. I mean, this could be a 50-year-old CSRS employee that's going to live off their retirement with a big inheritance. It could be someone with debt. It could be a divorcee.
I'm going to give you his profile. Oh, I said his. I usually never mention male or female.
All right.
Profile is FERS.
Okay.
Very intelligent. Very manages money well, no debt, etc.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what he is. He probably, I don't know what he's got in his thrift, nor would I say it if I did know.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's sizable. Mm-hmm. And with that and his years in service, I think he's going to be pretty well off. So given that profile.
Is he going to need his thrift money to live in retirement?
To a modest degree,
maybe
is my gut.
Yeah. For vacations or extra things,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
if that's the case, again, you still have to kind of do some calculations. Like I said a minute ago about people's risk tolerance, is trying to do the calculations to see how conservative can he be and meet every need and goal that he has. You know, if his goals can be met with a 3% or 4% rate of return, then 50% stocks and bonds may be too aggressive. As a general rule, to avoid sounding like I'm dodging the question, you know, it's not a bad mix as far as risk return goes for someone of that age, because, you know, the thing I like about having that sort of mix at that age is that if he does need income for something and the stock market is particularly poor at the time, we'll have bonds that we can take some of that income from, you know. And if at the same time he doesn't need all this money and it grow and he doesn't touch it for 20 years, we get the growth that the stocks would provide. So I hate to say in general, because then you'll have a 50-year-old listening who thinks, oh, well, then that's what I'll do. I'll go 50% stocks and bonds. And I think that's a little dangerous, because we have to always look at your own situation and your own circumstances and see what do you need your money to do for you before you make an allocation choice.
Yeah.
And your risk tolerance. I mean, you know, just like we said earlier, if this is someone who is currently 100% G and has never been in stocks and is saying, should I put half of my money in stocks? We might want to have a long conversation about what that journey is going to look like. Yeah.
He's not. He's probably, I guess he's 50-50, I guess.
Yeah.
And he's, you know, he's well-read, but he's, I don't believe he's a financial type like you. Okay, then he goes on to say, what's your opinion of market timing, which I think you already did in code.
Yeah, I mean, I really strongly believe that none of us have the ability, and even experts in the field and people much smarter than me have the ability to sort of read the tarot cards, if you will, and say, today the market will go up or down, and this is the bottom or this is the top. He goes on and the email to comment about people who got out of the markets in June when it declined. You know, that's what makes me nervous when I read stuff like that. It, you know, the fact that somebody would say, hey, the market's gone up, I'm going to get out now, you know, and take the profits and wait for it to go down and get back in. You know, again, I've just seen time and time again, people again with great reputations and experts in the field, that eventually you make a mistake. And if you want to talk about managing risk with diversification, spreading things out over time, you take your risk through the roof if you start yanking money in and out of the markets. Then you're basing your ability to meet your goals and get a good return on your own ability to read the market.
Let me ask you this. Often I've seen the individual investor that doesn't contact somebody like you, and they get out of the market and maybe they feel good because it drops some more. But they don't get back in at the right time.
It's two decisions to make.
At all.
Yeah. When do I get out? When do I get back in?
Yeah.
You know, I used to use for years, real quick, an example I thought was kind of illustrated this, is Y2K. When we had the big fear of the turn of the millennium and whether, you know, planes were going to be able to communicate with each other and the lights were going to come on, there were a certain percentage of people that had some worry about that. Not so much worry maybe that all those things were going to happen, but worry that it might affect the markets. So I had a lot of folks, I mean, literally almost every day I took phone calls from people saying, should I get out in anticipation in late 99 of Y2K? Well, the problem is, when do you get out? Do you get out in September? Do you get out the day before? And then if all the lights come on January 1st, do you get back in then? I mean, do you wait, see if everything's okay? What ended up happening was, is the last 6 weeks of that year, the market got almost all of its returns of 1999. So anyone who had timed the market missed it. And that's what's so dangerous about it, is the market can move right up. And then the higher it goes, the more you think, man, I should have gotten back in. Well, I'll get back in now, just in time for it to go down again. Right. So there's just too many stories I could tell you from doing these seminars and from just hearing stories from people that I come in contact with, where the timing is what killed them, not the investments that they picked.
Okay. I have to ask you a question.
Yeah.
I'm riding down to the show this morning, and of course I listen to Federal News Radio and their sister, brother station, whatever it is, WTOP. And they said, the stock futures are down 4 points. What is a stock future? Is it corn?
No, what a stock future is there are futures that you can trade the market. It's kind of complex to get into, but what it does is they announce it on CNBC every morning and on the various media outlets as a way to give you a heads up before the market opens at 9:30 on what the markets are looking like. You know, if futures are down, then people are making bets that they think the market will be down.
So somebody's today actually buying something called a future.
Hopefully no one listening to this show.
Oh, of course not. That's why I didn't understand. Anyway, so what I'm getting at then there, too, is with regards to mutual funds, it seems to be a few people with mutual funds.
Sure.
They're fairly sharp people, I would think, running most of those, I guess.
Well, and mutual funds are, the advantage of a mutual fund is you take away the individual security decision of, do I buy Home Depot or Lowe's? You let experts who have access to the companies and, you know, who have research analysts that look at nothing but hardware stores. They're going to know more about whether Home Depot is a good buy than, frankly, you or even myself. I mean, even doing this for a living. I mean, I have charts and graphs I can look at and research reports, but certainly I would rely on the experts for those sorts of things.
Interesting you say that. One of the lead articles one of your trade rags I was reading this weekend, it says Restoration Hardware is rich. Now, I remember Restoration Hardware where they sold kind of hardware kind of things, you know, polish and oils and this and that. Mm-hmm. And then they had some furniture. And now I get these, whatever they call it, magazines. I mean,
it's like the Pottery Barn now, isn't it? Isn't it?
Right. It takes a hand truck to get it out of the mailbox into the house. And I'm going, boy, that's a lot of money to send, you know, that kind of information. But Restoration Hardware is rich. I guess they mean it's got a lot of cash.
Yeah, you bring something up, Bob, that I want to touch on that. You know, you mentioned that one of the magazines or rags you're talking about that you look at. That those magazines and the Wall Street Journal and CNBC and all of the resources that a lot of people look at for the markets, I think one good perspective to always have is that they are of the perspective of the short term. You know, when you really watch CNBC, that's what they're talking about because their goal is to get you to watch their channel. So their short term is the focus, that the market is very exciting. What's going to happen today? And, oh, and this stock is up $20 and this one is down and they're going bankrupt. And it creates it. My heart's racing just talking about it. For the average investor, particularly the federal investor with the pension and the health insurance and all the things that go with being a federal employee, most of what goes on those channels is inconsequential, that they need to have their eyes on a much longer term prize and longer term goal rather than whether the futures are up or Restoration Hardware is having a good quarter. These aren't things that I think the average person should feel like. I think I talk about this a lot because I think people feel overwhelmed with investing because of these sort of things. They think if I don't have a handle on all of these things that I'm going to miss.
Okay. Well, we have a caller that you can enlightened just as you enlightened everyone else for the last 3 minutes. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm a FERS employee, and I am planning on retiring in January, just like the previous caller. Mm-hmm. And, of course, lots of the estimates of what we're going to need as income post-retirement say that we're supposed to have between 70 and 80% of our salary. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering whether that's gross salary or what you actually spend, mm-hmm. because there's a huge difference between those two figures.
Yeah,
especially if you're not, if you're a good saver, that makes a big difference.
Let me tell you an easy way to kind of figure this out. I get this question a lot, is that what I'm really concerned about, and I imagine most retirees are, is what you have in your checking account every month to spend on you. I mean, what your lifestyle costs. So what I would do is instead of aiming off of your gross salary, is look at your take-home pay now. You know, mm-hmm. take that number, you do it on a net basis. And so then, so say your take home, let's just throw a number, is $6,000, $5,000, whatever number dollars a month. Mm-hmm. Then what you can look at there is how much of that take home currently are you saving? Mm-hmm. You know, obviously, if you're saving $1,000 a month, that we don't need to replace that in retirement. We just need what you need to live. So some people find that, yeah, they're making $100,000+, but they really only need about $5,000 a month to live. That's their take home now. And really, they're saving about $1,000 of that. Then you can even furthermore take out of that number expenses that'll go away when you retire. Mm-hmm. You know, some people have, you know, mortgages that they're going to downsize their home and have a lower mortgage, or kids that are now out of the house. Mm-hmm. So I like to kind of look at it that way rather than just say you're going to need 70% of your gross, because, you know, a lot of federal employees save quite a bit of their income. When you save the money in the TSP, you're paying for your annuity, you're maybe saving additional money, you may need far less than 70%. And a lot of it, too, depends on what you have planned for retirement, what your lifestyle might look like.
That's perfect. That's actually exactly what I wanted to hear.
Oh, good, so good. Great. That's a much easier way to do it than try to go off your gross salary.
I do have a follow-up question, if I could.
Sure.
And that's that because I'm leaving January 11th, I'm wondering if there's any way to maximize the TSP in that amount of time. Can I write, like, for example, a check for the catch-up portion of it, or Is there any...
You can only contribute to the TSP through your payroll, okay. So you can't write checks to the TSP. So the best you can do, unless Bob has another brilliant idea...
I got an idea, but it isn't going to get you to where you want.
No, you won't max it
if you're going out January 11th. The first thing you can't use for the TSP is your accumulated leave. So what you're talking about is the compensation that you made from January 1st to the day you leave. You can take all of that. Now, that's not going to get you near your total, and you can put it into the TSP. However, it's unrealistic to think that you can put it all in because you do have to pay for things that are not tax-oriented, like health insurance and maybe a flexible spending account or something like that. But if you were to skinny that down and then have virtually no taxes withheld from it because it's all going into the TSP. It's crazy to have taxes withheld just to get it refunded a year later. So that would provide you an opportunity to get more money in. But remember, it's going to be based on your December salary and whatever you made in January, and that'll be it.
So you won't get to the max, but that's one way to get more in than just your normal paycheck.
It's called front-loading the thrift.
Yeah.
That's affectionately what it's called.
Of course, if you know, you'll love this recommendation, but you could work till March and maybe max it out.
Yeah.
Pass on that?
Yeah, no. So, Bob, you were saying something about the December salary might be...
Yeah, but the salary that you made through December 31st hasn't been paid to you yet.
Oh.
The paycheck that comes
paycheck,
in the new year.
It's always behind. So you're going to get whatever that paycheck is that you earned in December and January, and then you're going to get the 11 days that you would have earned in
And you can put
January.
That whole paycheck, is what Bob's saying, into the TSP minus
the non-discretionaries.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the December one already has some funds allocated to the 2013 TSP.
It does.
Right?
It does, but you're going to say, I want more taken out. You can mm-hmm. tell them to take out a certain amount, but your salary is X, and the only things that have to be subtracted are things like health insurance and those maybe even life insurance. Mm-hmm. But you don't have to have any federal or state taxes withheld, although that's difficult to stop them to do it, but you might want to start that in December.
Interesting. Okay, thank you so much. I appreciate the good information and love the show.
Great,
sure.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
All righty. Got another call, Andrew? You're smiling. Okay, Andrew says no. All righty, so back to the...
He's just smiling.
He's a happy guy. And we're happy that he's happy. Anyway, so let's go back to where were we with the questions, and you were developing a thought, and I forget where we were.
Well, you want me to? I'll tell you. There's two email questions we have in front of us, and they both have in them one similar question. And it's frankly something that I've gotten plenty of phone calls and emails and questions at seminars about. Is people feel like the markets have gone up considerably over the last 3 or 4 years, the U.S. large cap stock market. And the question is, you know, is this a good time? Should I be pulling money out of the markets? You know, I know that's one thing we hear a lot of people ask at times like this. And the interesting thing is one of these emails that we're going to get to says, you know, should I buy bonds? Would that be the place to go? And two answers to this. One is we're market timing again. I mean, we're making the call that we think because the market is at a certain level that something else is going to happen that we just flat out don't know. I mean, the 80s and 90s were a great example of that, where the market went up for, you know, essentially 16 straight years, you know, and it was easy to just sort of look at it and go, well, it's going to have to crash, going to have to crash, and eventually it goes down. But when is that going to happen is the hard part. But the other issue is, okay, you go into bonds. Well, bonds typically do very poorly when interest rates rise. And, you know, I don't know that I think interest rates shoot way up. I think we've seen mortgage rates and some other rates rise just a tad in the last little bit. But I certainly don't see them plummeting to where, where can they plummet to? So I don't know that bonds would be the place to go either. In general, you want to avoid looking into that crystal ball and just have an allocation that can handle the storms so that you can be comfortable with it and enjoy your retirement or the rest of your career.
All right. I know somebody's listening and saying, what about dollar cost averaging? Mm-hmm. So let's say you were in the F fund. We're not picking on the F fund. It could just as well be the C.
Mm-hmm.
And because interest rates, there, you know, whatever the rumor is that Bernanke is going to talk about this week, could drive bonds down because there's a fear that interest rates could go up. Now, down is not by a multiple of 50% or something,
they
would drop and would cause somebody some angst. But each month when the interest is paid, if it's within the F fund or a mutual fund, they're buying it at a lower cost. So there are good days, there are bad days.
Mm-hmm.
If they're in the F fund, same thing applies to the G as well as the other ones.
Mm-hmm.
But these, I would imagine the G and the C are the most... You could understand them better than maybe the international fund,
mm-hmm.
or things like that. I'm not picking on the international fund because, you know, it looks like a seismograph if you look at the ups and downs of it. It's up and it's down, but the thrift board picks the best of the best within that category.
Mm-hmm.
So they try to keep the risk level down.
Well, actually, to be honest, they're index funds.
Yeah.
So all they really are is mirror the index. So if you have the I fund, you're going to have the international index that we all use to measure the market. So I wouldn't say that I wouldn't necessarily agree that they try to keep the risk down, because you could buy a privately managed fund that maybe reduces the risk a little bit. You could also buy one that has a lot more risk, you know, but they do try to, at least you don't have the risk of management. You don't have the risk of, are the TSP funds any good? You know, they're simply computer run tracking the indexes. But, you know, you mentioned dollar cost averaging, I think was your question.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we've already seen it, for instance, if you know, we were to talk about bonds particularly struggling if interest rates were to rise. Year to date, and as of June 30th, I don't have the up to the minute data, but year to date, the F fund is down. The F fund is down about 2.5% for the year, where the G fund is positive. Those are the two safe, quote unquote, funds in the TSP, where you would go if you weren't worried about the long-term growth as much, but you wanted to protect what you had. And so some people have said, well, if I want to avoid the F fund in this sort of interest rate environment, and I'm 100% G, you could make the call to dollar cost average, which all that is moving a little bit at a time over time. As this, it really illuminates the real risk people have in their investments is yanking things in and out of investments at the wrong time. And it's so easy to do. Dollar cost averaging reduces that short-term impact. That's really what it boils down to.
Yeah.
Whatever you're going from portfolio A to portfolio B, if you really want to reduce the risk of it all, then the dollar cost averaging is the way to do it.
Okay. This thing I cut out of this trade publication, and it has investor grade bonds, Caterpillar, fairly substantial company, but it's 29 year before it matures, but it pays currently 4.55%, and somebody would say that's great. Well, along the ride between today and when it matures, it could go up or it could go down in mm-hmm. value based on the inversion of interest rates.
Mm-hmm.
So if interest rates go down, bonds go up. If interest rates go up, bonds go down.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd say, well, yeah, but aren't there shorter ones? Yeah, you can buy them. You can get, this is you, the individual investor, buying them, which probably is not a good idea, but they can go
usually
into the market and buy.
Yeah,
and I'm not picking on the individual. It's
sure.
It's just hard to know.
It's hard to diversify very well when you're doing that. You know, I mean, you wouldn't want to say somebody has $50,000 in savings and say, let's put it all in a Caterpillar bond that matures 30 years from now. You know, that wouldn't make much sense. So you'd want to be able to diversify more. But what your point is about the interest rate is you can lock that in, and if you hold the bond till it matures, you'll get 4.5%, assuming Caterpillar stays afloat. You'll get 4.5%, and then you get your money back. But the question is, what is inflation doing during that time? What are interest rates doing? I mean, if 10 years from now you could get your 10 years into the bond, you could buy a 20-year bond with a 9% yield. You're going to really kind of not be a big fan of your 4.5% bond. And if you wanted to get out of it, you're going to have to sell it at market values, which would be much lower at that time.
Yeah. People have a hard time with that. Why mm-hmm. why do they go down if interest rates go up?
Well, I think most people tend to think of bonds as something you hold till it matures. They don't think about selling it in the interim. It's kind of I think the client's CD experience is what they lean on, is that I buy a CD at the bank and I wait for it to mature and I get interest. But they don't realize sometimes that the CDs even fluctuate in price if they were to sell them in the secondary market.
Right. And I'll say one thing. Somebody's going to say, well, you used a private industry example of a bond. Treasuries go up and down based on interest rates. Guaranteed investments. But if you were to sell, like Joe said, before it matures, you might get more or you might get less depending on what interest rates have done to
it. And it's an important point to bring full circle to the TSP with the F fund is that's how come the F fund can go down is people are confused by that. They think bonds, aren't they safe? I bought bonds and I'm losing money. The reason why they can go down is you don't have the option to hold the F fund till it, quote, matures. The F fund is a portfolio of a whole bunch of different bonds. And so every day they're valued based on the current market rates. So that's how come the F fund can do quite well. I mean, it's had years where it's made double digits, but it can also decline.
Okay, good. I was just checking the iPhone for emails to us. I wasn't being rude, Joe.
Well, and one thing I think the more we talk about this, I always want to bring back is when you get into the weeds of talking about the F fund that's by itself and the I fund by itself, and then people kind of take that as, well, where should I put my TSP? Well, which one are they really talking about that they think is good? I want to reiterate, I think the allocation, the approach of dividing your money among these categories, even if we think our crystal ball tells us the F fund might struggle, we may have a piece in it because it creates a balance that gives us lower risk over time and more predictability.
Okay. Should we go back to the questions?
Sure.
One of the questions, should I have a six-month rainy day fund? Mm-hmm. If the government shuts down, and what percentage of that should be in equities? Of course, it's going to get back to Joe's outstanding comment. I can't make a comment on that without knowing the person behind it. But this rainy day fund, I mean, that's been around since forever, the 6 months. And it's there for another reason, so that if there was a stoppage of cash flow to ones, that there would be a place to be able to buy groceries by taking money out of it.
Well, I can tell you, I can hit one part of it real quick. It should not be in equities. I mean, the point of a rainy day fund is to have cash on hand if you need it for an emergency or, you know, whether it's maybe sequestration, maybe it's a layoff, maybe it's, you know, a financial hardship of some other kind. So you want it to be there. You know, I mean, I would hate for somebody to have some adverse financial situation and then the $50,000 they put in a rainy day fund is now worth $30,000 because we're in a market downturn. So by no means should it be in equities. As far as the 6 month go, you know what? I kind of let people off the hook on this one a little bit. You know, the book says, you know, the CFP study materials that I read through to become a financial planner say 6 months. You know, that's the number that gets thrown out there, the answer on the test. I tend to tell people whatever makes you feel comfortable. I mean, for some people, they're fully invested, but they know that if they need money, they have investments they can get the money out of very quickly. It's a very liquid world. You know, now we can get money out of not necessarily the TSP or long-term things like that, but mutual funds and the like you could get out of. But there are other people that frankly need far more than 6 months to feel good at night. You know, I wouldn't want to have somebody spend down all their savings and only have 6 months and not sleep for the next 2 years.
Not good.
So it's sort of I think it's a comfort level, but it should be in the bank and it will be earning nothing, but it will be there if you need it.
Okay. Give us a call and talk to the financial psychologist, Joe Sullender, 202-465-3080, 202-465-3080. By the way, he's not a financial psychologist. He is with Wells Fargo Advisors, and he's a senior vice president investments. And his name is Joe Sullender.
Yeah. And if anybody also, I mean, we usually give out, if you have follow-up questions, I can certainly share my email directly as well, which is joseph.sullender, S-U-L-L-E-N-D-E-R, at wellsfargoadvisors, with an O.com. And one more time to make sure we spell it right, Bob, is joseph.sullender, S-U-L-L-E-N-D-E-R, at wellsfargoadvisors.com. So feel free. I mean, I answer emails from seminars and referrals and clients and from the radio. I'm more than happy to, if you have a follow-up question, to address it for you.
Yes, and his telephone voice is as good as his radio voice.
Oh, thank you.
And the information as well. All righty, so back to our email questions. there's a term that sometimes when people they talk about risk and they talk about beta. So if you,
yeah.
I mean, I'm talking about reading something, maybe even like a money magazine. Mm-hmm. They'll talk about a beta, mm-hmm. but I thought betas went out with Peter Pan. This is not a beta machine, right? This is a
well, it was a kind of fish, maybe.
Right.
Beta is actually one of the few. I mentioned earlier how I think risk lies in the emotional side of the brain and not in the like statistic side of the brain. But beta is the one statistic that I do point clients to and try to talk about. And that is, if you have a mutual fund, let's say, as I mentioned earlier, that the TSP funds are all index funds. So if you're in the C fund, you're in the S&P 500, which is 500 largest companies in our country monitored by the Standard & Poor's index. That's basically what it is. So if you were to go out and buy your own mutual fund that buys large cap stocks and you've done some research or seen it in a magazine, said, I want to see about this fund, you might see it has better returns than the C fund and the S&P. It might have lesser returns. What beta gives you a feel for is how much risk it's taking relative to that index. So if I look at, you know, a large company stock fund and it has a beta of 1.5, then that means this fund is taking 1.5 times as much risk as the index itself. So if I buy that fund, I would expect the returns to reflect that. That if the index was up 10%, I should be up 15. If the index was down 10%, I should be down 15. So for those people that want to really buy their own mutual funds, kind of research them a little bit, the beta is a great number to see, to see what kind of returns I should expect. I mean, I can tell somebody what they should expect from the stock market performance over the long haul, but if the beta of your funds is higher or lower, that's going to affect that. So it's a good way to kind of get a relative measure of the risk that you're taking.
Okay, I don't want to get into the weeds with this, but I'll get a little bit into the weeds. Somebody might say, well, wouldn't all of them have a beta of 1? Because how could fund F, fund 1
okay.
versus fund 2 buying the same thing have a different beta? And as I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, within the funds, some funds are allowed to do things like sell options on their shares.
It isn't even quite that complex.
Okay.
It's that if you buy an S&P 500 fund, mm-hmm. it's going to have that list of 500 stocks, period, with the same weighting that they are in the index. If you buy a managed fund, the manager is going to have the ability to decide what to buy. And there's some funds out there that only have 30 or 40 stocks in them. You know, they don't have 500 names. They've got 10% of the portfolio in Apple, for instance. There are other funds that lean more towards, like you mentioned, dividend paying stocks, and they only buy the dividend paying stocks. Some may buy ones that aren't in the S&P 500 at all. So it's sort of an open slate when you buy a managed mutual fund as far as what they buy. And it could be more complex strategies with options and things, but more often than not, it's just the style of what the criteria is for the stocks that the particular fund is buying.
Okay, great. Because I look at it and then I look at it'll be red or it'll be green. And you know, I understand red and green, but I think I understand the beta, but I think a lot of people don't. But it's a commonly used term if they read it. And again, these are not the highfalutin magazines. It could mm-hmm. be Money Magazine. There's nothing wrong with Money Magazine, but Money Magazine, I guess, is for people that really don't study the market and can get a feel for it.
We're on radio. I probably shouldn't comment on Money Magazine.
I didn't figure you would. I figured I'd say it, but I'm not suggesting people read it. It's just I don't want them to think all this stuff is out of Barron's or what's the one from Financial Times? Yeah. That stuff you read.
One great story on Money Magazine is for years they put the 10 best funds, you know, that you must own for the upcoming mm-hmm. year. And almost every year they're 10 completely different funds. So there's a little bit of, you know, crystal balling going on there as well.
I like Money Magazine in one sense because it's got real life articles in it. But I always look at it as it's kind of a magazine like People.
Yeah.
But it's people with money and what they do with it. And those articles are good. Like we had a caller earlier, should I have X percent of my compensation? And mm-hmm. your answer was right on target. No, it's really, do you need 100% of your take-home pay and where is it going to come from?
Well, and it's just like CNBC. I mean, you can weed out the factual and informative long-term planning things among the drama and the short-term excitement. And then same of any magazine as well. With the right perspective, there's lots of good information available.
Yeah, you know, those. Anyway, let's get off of the shows and whatnot. What else do we have left from our good buddy? You've looked at the emails probably closer than I. Some of the questions we may not want to do. But I think we covered the gist of them. And I think we have a little less than 3 minutes left. So why don't we summarize what we did, Joe?
Sure. I think when it comes to risk, everybody spends so much time focused on the worries of a market crash. That's what we're all worried about. We all went through it in 08, 09. We went through it in 2000 through 2002. And I'm worried that as I near retirement or whatever part of my career that I'm in, that all of a sudden my TSP just implodes. Well, the way that we protect ourselves against that is by building an allocation in our portfolio that reflects what kind of returns we think we need to meet our goals, but also what kind of risk we think we could stomach. And if we're nearing retirement and feel like a 20% market, a 20% decline in our TSP would ruin us, then we need to change our allocation. Even if it means we make less money than what we're in, it's better because we're in something we can stick with. The biggest mistake I really believe people make is moving money in and out of things at the wrong time. And it's so, so easy when times get tough and we start to worry and get nervous. You turn on the media, it tells you you should be scared to death. And you feel like, I can't just sit here and play the violin while all my money goes to nothing. I've got to do something. And that reaction usually is to get out at the low point. And that's really, I think, the real key is to have an allocation that you can be comfortable with over the long haul and understand the risk that you're taking. Most people don't understand the risk in their portfolios.
Yeah, and I don't want to sound self-serving with it, too. If somebody's uncomfortable with that, they really need to seek professional advice. It's like anything else, like going to the doctor, going to the accountant, mm-hmm. going to the attorney, because they know this area.
Well, they'll tell you how much risk you need to take to meet your goals and how much risk you are taking. And hopefully a good advisor or planner can help you determine what your risk tolerance is. It's a difficult thing to know, but hopefully they can help you, you know, at least be upfront and say, here's what could happen. How do you feel about this?
Okay, one more time. How does somebody get in touch with you so you can help them?
Sure. They can email me at joseph.sullender, and that's S-U-L-L-E-N-D-E-R, at wellsfargoadvisors.com, and it's advisors with an O.
Okay. And what we just did is we walked through risk. We defined it. We talked about how to keep away from it if it was to make us feel overly anxious. And we're going to be off the air, so you won't be able to call us, but you can email us for F-O-R, your, Y-O-U-R, benefit, at NITPINC.com. Not necessarily for today, though that's Joe's email address that he gave you, but anytime you have a question on pennies, bucks, taxes, legal, we can give you general advice, not specific.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thanks for listening, and we'll be back next week with Tammy, and we're going to talk about the voluntary contribution and how to get traditional IRA money into a Roth tax-free. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP. Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely devoted to you, the federal employee. The show can also be heard 24/7 on federalnewsradio.com. Thanks for listening.